Hello, welcome to the Physics 142 lecture for September 16th, 2010. Please download the PDF slides that accompany this MP3 file, and we'll just start right out on slide one. So last time we discussed the concept of electric flux, and the idea with electric flux is it is the amount of electric field that passes through some surface area. I find that often thinking about electric flux, it's useful to think about water flow. So you can imagine if you had the end of a hose, basically spouting water out in the middle of a bucket, and then surrounding that end of the hose you had a wire screen mesh, then the water would be coming out of the end of the hose and would be flowing out through that mesh. And so you could imagine the electric flux through the water flux through the mesh. It is something that I sometimes will use with my mind in trying to imagine what's happening with electric field lines, just thinking them of the electric field lines as flowing water. At any rate, you can imagine, if you look down at the bottom of slide one, you can imagine having some arbitrarily shaped surface and some arbitrary electric field. And it is an important thing to be able to determine what is the electric flux through that surface. So the surface will have many different directions, and the orientation of a surface is really determined by the little n-hat vector that is attached to the surface. That basically is a normal vector to the surface, and as the surface changes orientation, so does the direction of n-hat. Conventionally, if you have a closed surface, n-hat points outward. The component of the electric field, which is parallel to n-hat, that is, the component of the electric field that is headed out through the surface perpendicularly, is given by the electric field dotted into n-hat. So if we were to now compute the flux, and the flux is basically the electric field weighted, the penetrating electric field weighted average, or not average, but sum of the electric field passing through the surface, then the flux is the integral over that entire surface of E dot dA, where E dot dA contains both the it projects out the component of electric field that's perpendicular to the surface and then multiplies it by the surface area, basically. And you integrate this thing over, you have to integrate it because, of course, the surface and the electric field are both changing, so you can't just treat it as a constant. So let's go to slide two. The reason that the flux calculation is so important is that we basically use it in doing Gauss's, and it's used in Gauss's law. And Gauss's law is particularly important and useful for us because electric field calculations can be notoriously difficult in many instances. And Gauss's law takes advantage of symmetry. If you have a situation with certain symmetry, you can actually use Gauss's law to calculate an electric field much more simply. So Gauss's law is given in the middle of slide two, well, at the top of slide two, and is circled in red. So it's the surface integral of E dot dA, and that's equal to the charge enclosed in that surface divided by epsilon naught. So one thing to keep in mind is that this is a theoretical surface. It might correspond to an actual surface, or it might be an imaginary surface. Gauss's law holds true no matter what. It's true in general. Gauss's law is particularly useful under conditions of symmetry. So if you look in the middle of slide two, you can see that I've basically tried to deconstruct Gauss's law, and I have comments that are color-coded for particular things. First of all, you'll note that the left-hand side is an integral over a hypothetical Gaussian surface. And in doing a Gauss's law problem, you choose that surface to be in a region where you're interested in knowing the electric field. the integral is over the entire surface, and it's a closed surface. So you're computing the flux through that Gaussian surface, so it's the integral of E dot dA. And this particular integral can be arbitrarily difficult if I give you some weird potato charge or something. But in the case of if you have a problem with a certain symmetry and you select the Gaussian surface correctly, then this integral can be quite doable. So, for example, what simplifies this integral is that if the dot product is simple, and the dot product is simple if E and dA are parallel or perpendicular. So if you have a surface where they're parallel, then this integral of E dot dA becomes the integral of E times dA, and it's a scalar. Remember that scalar is just a number, like a temperature, and it doesn't include the direction that you have with the vectors. If you have portions of your surface where E and dA are perpendicular to one another, then E dot dA is zero, and it doesn't contribute to the surface. So the trick is, given a particular problem, to choose a symmetry where E and dA are parallel or perpendicular to one another. Most of the time, you'll see you will be choosing them where they are parallel to one another, but there are times where you'll see it where they're perpendicular. Now, the right-hand side is the charge enclosed in that Gaussian surface divided by epsilon naught. Q enclosed is sometimes simply known or given to you in the problem. Sometimes it is the hard part to figure out because you're having to choose your Gaussian surface. If your Gaussian surface, say, is outside of the total charge distribution, then you know that Q enclosed is just the total charge. If it's inside your charge distribution, then what you're trying to calculate there is actually how much charge is inside that Gaussian surface, and you'll have to integrate rho dV throughout that surface in order to get that Q enclosed. Okay, so let's move on to slide 3. The symmetries where Gauss's law is particularly useful are generally spherically symmetric problems, as shown up in the top, where the Gaussian surface n hat points out radially, and in a spherically symmetric problem, the electric field is going to point out radially or inward radially, depending on the sign of the net charge in the middle. But there's nothing else to break the symmetry of the problem. Cylindrically symmetric problems are also useful. You can imagine anything that involves some sort of a line charge or a power line or something like that is going to have cylindrical symmetry. And in cylindrical symmetry, the Gaussian surface one typically chooses is a cylinder where the center of the distribution is centered on the axis of the cylinder. And in this case, we actually use three pieces when we do the Gaussian surface sum. One is the surface of the pipe of the cylinder, and in that region, E and N hat are both pointed out radially. But then, remember, we have to have a closed surface, which means we have to have N caps to the pipe. And in that case, the N caps look like disks that the axis of the cylinder or the line of charge passes through, and N hat points outward parallel to the axis of the symmetry of the problem, and E hat will still point out radially due to the symmetry of the problem. So E and N hat are then perpendicular to one another, so it doesn't contribute to the integral. Now, I'm also assuming in this case that we have an infinite line charge. If the charge wasn't infinite or very, very long, then, in fact, E and N hat would not be perpendicular to one another. But you'll find usually we'll consider it in the infinite length approximation. The other symmetry that's often useful is planar symmetry. So this, if you have some sort of Cartesian rectangular symmetry to the problem. And then often what you want to use is something that is usually called a pillbox. So it's basically a cylinder which is bisected by the plane of charge, and then you have the flat top and bottom of the pillbox or the cylinder, where E and N hat will be pointing along one another, and the circular side where E will actually, there will be no E penetrating through. N hat and E are perpendicular to one another. Okay, sorry, I needed to make annotations. All right, so now if we go to slide 4, Gauss's law can be used for a number of things, and one of the things I'd like to do is to see if we can learn something about the status of the charge. Where does the charge reside in a conductor? So let us imagine that we have a chunk of a conductor, which I have drawn by the green numeral 1 on the left-hand side. And first, let's imagine that this conductor is placed in an electric field, which is shown in blue here. Now, initially, at the very instant when the conductor is first placed, there's no, the electric field lines are in the conductor, and the point about a conductor is what makes an object conducting is that the charge flows freely. If I have charges in a conductor, the whole thing could have a net charge of zero, but it is made up of positive and negative charges that you think of as flowing freely in the conductor. That's how we define a conductor. So a conductor in an electric field will cause charge to flow. So what will happen is that you will get negative charges flowing upward and positive charges flowing downward along the electric field lines. So there will be a net charge separation within this conductor, this black box that I basically have put there. Imagine it's a solid conductor. So the charges basically will separate. Now notice, so if you look where I have a Roman numeral 2, I show the charges that are separated in response to the electric field. And if we now look at the electric field of the separated charge, that is shown in orange, and of course it goes from positive to negative. And it is, it basically is in the opposite direction of the electric field, the external electric field, the blue electric field that was coming down that caused the charge to separate. And so if we look at the bottom of slide 4, at the picture on the lower left side where we have the Roman numeral 3, you can see the situation. We have an external electric field that's blue, headed down, and you separate the charge, and then you get an internal electric field due to the separated charge that's headed up. And this charge will continue to separate until that internal electric field has grown in strength enough that it actually cancels out the blue external charge inside the conductor. You know that this has to happen because if you have an electric field inside the conductor, the charge will continue to flow. So basically, if it comes to equilibrium, it has to come to equilibrium so that the electric field inside is zero. So we know by virtue of the fact that it is a conductor that the electric field is zero inside the conductor because this physical process is happening. So now what I'd like to do is to take a conductor and where I have placed charge on the conductor, and I would like to calculate Gauss's law. So imagine, what I'd like to do is to, So what I would like to do is imagine that we have a piece of conductor, which is sort of like this weird shape by the Roman numeral 4, the green shape is some sort of strange solid conductor. And let us say for the moment that I deposit some charge in the middle of that conductor. So that's represented by the 6 positive charges that I just put inside that conductor. Where do those charges reside, actually, after you deposit them and let them go? Well, what we can do is imagine that we have a Gaussian surface, which is just inside the green surface of the potato, okay? And, of course, it doesn't have a symmetry. Don't worry about that right now. This is one of the instances where we can use the general aspect of Gauss's law to a good end. Gauss's law is true for any closed surface. So we have the little Gaussian surface shown in light blue just inside the surface of the green potato. Sorry, let me make a note on the slides. And let's evaluate Gauss's law on that particular surface. And at first you go, my God, I can't evaluate it because that's some weird surface. So how do I do this integral? Well, let's think about it for a moment. If you look at the charge in that conductor, there will be an electric field in that conductor. So what will happen is that the conducting charge within this whole system of this net charge you've thrown in there plus whatever else, other free charges, and the conductor you can think of as neutral to begin with, and now I deposit some charge in there, and now the charge is going to rearrange in the system until the net electric field inside the conductor is zero, because it has to do that. Otherwise, charge will be flowing and we don't have a static situation. We are considering at this stage electrostatics, or the situation only after the charges have stopped moving. So you can deposit net charge in the middle of this conductor, but things will all move around until the electric field everywhere inside the conductor is zero. So that means that the integral of E dot dA, where E being the electric flux through the surface of that conductor or through the surface of the Gaussian surface that we have, which is just inside the surface of the conductor, has to be zero because just inside the surface of that conductor, the electric field is zero. So the left-hand side of Gauss's law is zero, which means automatically that the right-hand side of Gauss's law is zero, which means there is no enclosed charge inside this blue-dotted Gaussian surface in this conductor, which means that the charge in a conductor in a static situation must reside on the surface of the conductor. Okay, so you may be beginning to get the picture that your days of dealing with Cartesian coordinates, for the most part, or only, are basically over. The Cartesian world is great fun, but it's rather limited. So we're going to now become adventurous and learn to live a little bit and start dealing with things in curvilinear coordinates. The Cartesian coordinates are particularly useful for our limited little biased minds, but it turns out that it is much better to choose coordinate systems that fit the symmetry of the problems. It makes things much, much easier to analyze and calculate. So you can imagine that we could have some form of a general coordinate, and such things do exist. So if you look on slide 5, you could imagine having coordinate axes that have all sorts of weird shapes, in fact. And there, at some point in your physics career, in undergraduate or maybe early graduate school, hopefully you'll see a treatment of basic generalized curvilinear coordinates. But right now what we're going to do is to look at a couple of very particularly useful types of coordinates for the symmetries of problems that will be seen in our electromagnetism. So let's move to slide 5. I'm sorry, slide 6. So let's start out by recalling the relationship between the arc length, the radius, and the angle in a circle. So look where I have the green number 1 circled, and we have let's say we have a basic circle in the plane of the paper, and it has a radius, little r, and if we also define an angle theta, which subtends an arc length, basically, on the surface of that circle, then the relationship between S, R, and theta is given beneath there, S equals R theta. So this is a standard relationship that hopefully you all have been using for many years. So the next thing I would like to do is to find the area of a circular disk. So if you look at the drawing up by the Roman numeral 2, what we have is a disk that's in the XY plane, and the Z-axis subtends it's centered on the Z-axis, has a radius big R, and let's calculate the area. To calculate the area, we need to sum up all of the little differential areas, and the differential area, I have one drawn in the figure by Roman numeral 2. It's a little area which is dr and in length along the r direction and ds in width. And the area then is going to be dr times ds, basically the differential radius times the differential arc length, and we want to find the area by just summing up all of those. I can convert the ds into rd theta, so dA can be considered ds times rd theta d phi. Remember, because of the relationship between the arc length, the radius, and theta, the arc length basically has a radial scaling built in it. And typically what you want to do is integrate over the angle, so you have to put in that radial scaling, that little scale factor. In this case, it's R. So ds is thought of as rd theta. At the bottom, we can actually do the calculation. So to sum up the area, we want to integrate over all the little dAs, but dA is really made up of a d theta piece and a dr piece. So we want to do a two-dimensional integral, one over the angle theta and one over r. So you can imagine being at some fixed r, and you have a little area which is differential r in width, and it's ds in arc length, and you just sum up at that fixed r all the little ds's, and that would be the theta integral that you see in the equation where we have Roman numeral 5. Basically, we're integrating from 0 to 2 pi all the little d theta elements at some fixed r. So in this case, you're integrating over theta, and the radius is independent of theta at this point. So you can go to where we have equation 6. This double integral, this two-dimensional integral, really turns into two single-dimensional integrals. So you have an r piece and a theta piece. And you can integrate theta, d theta, from 0 to 2 pi, and you just get 2 pi. You can integrate r from 0 to big R. The integral of R is R squared over 2. So you can get that is evaluated as big R squared over 2, and the angular piece is 2 pi. The 2's cancel, and you end up with the area of the circle being pi R squared. So this is really formally how you go and calculate the area. This little area of a circle is pi R squared formula that you've always known. If we go to slide 7, there's another system of coordinates that you might want to, that you'll want to become expert in. There is a link that I have at the bottom of this slide that might be useful to look at to sort of figure out. Some of these things are a little bit difficult to draw, so some of the pictures might be confusing, especially when we get into spherical coordinates. So in cylindrical coordinates, you can imagine having one coordinate be the radius of a cylinder, where the cylinder is centered on the origin, I guess. I mean, centered on the z-axis. So you have an axis. You have some sort of problem that has cylindrical symmetry, and the axis of the problem becomes the z-axis in the drawings. And so what you have is a z-coordinate, and then you have the radius of a circle, and then the angle that you are, the angle phi that you are around the circle. So if you look on the left-hand side, you can see the radial coordinate, and that is shown, and it is perpendicular to the z-axis, and it's shown in the xy plane. Then you can define the angle phi from the positive x-axis in the center piece, and then there will be a you have to look in the along the z-axis to get where you are with along z in the cylinder. So in cylindrical coordinates, you have r, phi, and z as the three things you need to consider. If you go to slide 8, you can see definition of spherical polar coordinates. So these are particularly useful for problems with spherical symmetry. So in this case, if you look at the upper left-hand corner, the r vector points to some point on the surface of a sphere, for example, and that point is defined by the radius itself, the length of that little vector. The angle that that vector makes with the z-axis, which is known as theta, which goes from 0 to pi, so it only goes all the way down till the r is going in the negative z direction. And then you have to define where you are azimuthally around the z-axis with the angle phi, which again is taken to be from the positive x-axis. Now, if you want to calculate, for example, something like the volume of a sphere, or you need to know the volume inside some sort of spherically symmetric surface, you're going to have to consider differential volumes in spherical polar coordinates. If we look at slide 8a, it might be useful to think about it this way. In this picture, in the center, you see a little strange-looking sort of box. That box is a volume element in spherical polar coordinates. It is a differential distance r in thickness in the radial direction, and it's it has a theta piece and a phi piece. Now the problem is we have this radial scaling that comes into play with both theta and phi. So if we were doing a Cartesian problem, then the volume of the box, if it were dx long, dx wide, dy wide, and dz thick, would just the volume would just be dx times dy times dz. The problem is that in spherical polar coordinates, things get a bit more complicated. This volume is made up of a dr piece. It's made up of a theta piece, but now theta has radial scaling in it, because what you really want is the length of that side of the box, which includes the radial scaling, just like we had when we had when we were looking at the circle. So in that case, the ds along the theta direction in the box becomes rd theta, just like we had with the circle. Then if you project down onto the xy plane and ask what is d phi in terms of what is d phi, then the projected length down is r sine theta, and then that becomes the radius of the d phi of the circle that you need when you're calculating d phi. So there's a scale factor that comes in for the phi piece, which is r sine theta d phi. So let me see. If we go back to slide 8, I tried drawing this a bit more carefully. I think the dr thickness of the thing is fairly straightforward. The rd theta side is very much just like the circle we had on slide 6. Okay, so that's where the scale factor comes in. It's just like the circle. Just imagine the circle is in the plane defined by the z-axis and the r-vector. And the trickier one is how to get the scale factor for phi. And so if you look on the lower right of page 8, you can see what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to determine the length of the phi side, which is the dl phi. And I show a little arrow. And you can see r is given by angle theta from the z-axis. And if we go into the xy plane to look at phi, the projected piece is r sine theta. That is basically the radius of, that is the projected length of r in the xy plane, and it is in that plane that we define phi. So in that case, the arc length that corresponds to the azimuthal circle around z is going to be the radius of that circle in the xy plane, which is going to be r sine theta, times d phi. So that's where the scale factor comes from phi. So what this means is that if we go on the left-hand side of slide 8 in the middle, the differential volume element that we have to consider in spherical polar coordinates goes as r squared times sine theta times d theta d phi dr. I think it's very important that you doodle on a piece of paper and look at these pictures and think about it to where you understand where these scale factors come from, this r squared and sine theta, because you'll be having to do stuff like this quite a lot. And it's unfortunately, this one is a lot easier for me to guide you through in person, because then I can refer to pieces as I'm talking about them, and it's very difficult to do that in this current format. So sorry about that. I will certainly be spending some time filling some holes when I return, and I'll be asking you to keep track of things that you didn't understand, and we'll spend a little time. I'll think about those things and see if some of them can be helped by the fact that I'm actually there and can point to a few things. So if you want to come back to this, we will. So let's go to slide 9, and you can see how this is used. Suppose what we'd like to do is to find the area of a sphere. That area is, so we divide up the sphere into all these little dAs, differential areas, and the area, given by equation 1, is the integral of all those little dAs. And that means we don't have to worry about the radial piece here, because we're trying to just solve for the area. So we end up needing the theta scaling piece. So we have an rd theta, and we have the phi scaling piece. So we have the r sine theta d phi. So we need to do an integral over theta and an integral over phi. And r is constant here. It's just the radius of the sphere. So the phi integral is easy. It's just 0 to 2 pi. And the r squared pulls out, and that leaves us with the theta integral, 0 to pi of sine theta d theta, which turns out to be 2. So in equation 3, that's where we get the 4 pi r squared. You can see here how important those scale factors are, because if we hadn't thought our way through that, if you don't understand where they came from on slides 8 and 8a, you won't get a simple integral like this correct, for example. Okay, so I think it's good for you to know how to do things in curvilinear coordinates in doing multiple integrals. That said, what I would like to do is to make life a bit easier for you, and I want to show you how to convert many of the problems that you're going to face into one-dimensional integrals and make life a little bit easier. And it takes advantage of the scale factors that we've just thought our way through. So I think what I'm trying to say to you is I think it's worth some struggle on your part to understand the scale factors, but in the end, I'm about to give you sort of tricks to keep in mind which will allow you to not have to worry about evaluating those every time you look at them, and you can avoid doing the multiple integrals. So earlier, if we look at the bottom of page 9, you see a picture of a circle, and we calculated the area, and recall that it became a double integral, 1 over the radial part and part over theta, and it gets a little complicated because dA is not just dr d theta, it's dr times r d theta, and you have to have that little scale factor to make it work for you. So another way to do this problem is to not think of the differential area as this little approximate square box on the midst of the circle. Instead, there is no constraint in doing integrals. You can actually have the differential piece of the area be any shape you'd like. And so the trick is to pick a differential area or a differential volume chunk in these problems that has the symmetry of the problem. So in the case of this circular problem, if on the lower right-hand side of slide 9, imagine how easy life gets, and this only works if you have a problem that has a certain symmetry. But imagine how easy life is if we take as our differential area element a little circular, excuse me, and we take as our little differential area a little circular element that has a thickness along the radial direction of dr. Well, what is the area of that ring-like sliver of area? Well, it's going to be 2 pi r, which is the circumference of that circle, 2 pi little r, okay? And it's going to be dr thick. So that differential area is 2 pi r dr. Now, this only works for a problem where you don't have some sort of angular dependence in things. So you have to be careful choosing this, doing this particular type of trick. So if we want to, for example, calculate the... So if you now go to the top of slide 10, we have a disk and we want to calculate the area. We assume that the dA is sort of that pink ring that you see, and it is has a circle of 2 pi r, little r, dr thick. You can assume that little r is constant throughout the thickness of that ring because it's differential. It's only dr thick, so you sort of think of the radius as not changing. So that means you can calculate the circumference of that circle both on the inner part and the outer part as being 2 pi r. And then you multiply that circumference times the thickness dr to get the 2 pi r dr as dA. And then to do the integral, you only have to integrate over r. So we've, by using the correct shape for the differential area element, we convert what is normally a two-dimensional integral into a one-dimensional integral, which is easier to do. So if you see the symmetry in the problem and you choose the correct differential element, you can make life a lot easier for you. So let's look at another example. Let's calculate the volume of a sphere. By the symmetry of the problem, the differential piece of volume that we want to use, the dV that works in this problem, is one where the angular pieces are already integrated out, if you want to think about it. So if you consider the sphere with a radius big R, which is pictured at the bottom of page 10, imagine choosing a volume differential element, dV, which is a thin spherical shell at little radius, at radius little r. Then the volume of the shell is going to be 4 pi r squared, which is the area of the surface of that cylindrical spherical shell, and then it's times a dr in thickness. So dv becomes 4 pi r squared dr. If you look back and see what happened when we integrated the angular pieces in spherical polar coordinate, you found that what you got was 4 pi r squared. So we're taking, we are conceptually integrating over the angular pieces. So this trick only works well if you have no angular dependence in the problem. So we're basically mentally just going ahead and doing the angular integrals. That's where the 4 pi r squared comes from. But conceptually, the way I think about it is you have the little shell, it has an area of 4 pi r squared, and then you multiply it by dr to make it a volume instead of an area. So that's where dv becomes 4 pi r squared dr at the bottom of page 10. And then all you have to do is sum up all those differential volumes by letting little r go from 0 out to big R. And so we are integrating from 0 to big R, 4 pi r squared dr, which gives you the final answer, which is the volume of the sphere, which I hope you know, which is 4/3 pi r cubed. Okay, so that's sort of curvilinear. That is not a general treatment of curvilinear coordinates. That's sort of a discussion about the types of curvilinear coordinates we'll be needing to use in this course. So now I think you'll actually become really good with these things as we do more and more problems. So let's go to slide 11 and do a sample problem to give you some practice on this. Let us suppose that we have a spherically symmetric distribution of charge at the top of slide 11, which has a radius big R. And let us assume that this distribution of charge has a charge density that is in coulombs per meter cubed that is equal to some constant times R cubed for R less than big R, and it's equal to 0 for R greater than or equal to big R. So there's nothing outside of big R, but within big the region where the charge is, the charge density grows as the cube of the radius. And K is just some constant. I choose K because we're already using K for other things in the class, and we have to make things as confusing as possible. The units of K, which is just some constant in this problem, must be such that things actually work. So, right, the units of charge density, volume charge density, is in coulombs per meter cubed. So if we now have on the right-hand side a meter cubed there already, and the total units need to be coulombs per meter cubed, and then the units of K will have to be in coulombs per meter to the sixth. So it is whatever it has to be in order for the units to work. Okay, so the question, the problem I'd like to start with is, let's find the total charge. In this case, the total charge, equation 1, we know is the integral of this charge density over the total volume. We only have to consider the volume from 0 out to big R because the charge density is 0 everywhere else, so the contribution to the integral for little r greater than or equal to big R is 0. So we're integrating dV, rho times dV, from 0 to big R. So we have on the right-hand side of equation 1, we have rho times dV, and the dV that we want to choose here is the one that is appropriate for spherical polar coordinates. So imagine that we have a little thin shell. It will have a surface area. It's at little radius r. It has a surface area 4 pi r squared, and then we multiply it by dr in thickness, and that will be the differential element that we choose. So then we go to equation 2, and the total charge is equal to the integral from 0 to big R of the 4 pi r squared dr, which is the dv we have from above, times what rho is, and which is kr cubed. And you can see now, if I have the radial dependence in rho, and I have this r dependence in the differential volume, I mean, I have to have both those pieces to get this thing correct, because they both contain r, and that's what I'm integrating over. So on the right-hand side of equation 2, you can pull out the constant things, the k, the 4, the pi, and we're left with the integral over r to the 5th dr. And so the final answer is going to be 4 pi k times r to the 6th, big r to the 6th over 6. All right, so let's now go to slide 12. And I would like to calculate, use these kinds of ideas that we've been talking about to calculate a very fundamental and important thing for us, which would be the electric field outside of an infinite line charge. So imagine having a very long wire and we deposit charge on it. That wire would have some charge per unit length, which we're going to call lambda. And I'd like to calculate the electric field outside of that line of charge. We specify that it is an infinite line charge because it allows us to use Gauss's law. Does it really have to be infinite? Well, certainly in the problem we're going to say that it is, but the truth is if you have a length of a charge, and so long as you're considering radii that are not very far from the wire relative to the length of the wire, this approximation that the wire is infinite is very good. So although it may sound a little wacky to start talking about infinite line charges because nobody knows how to make one of those, the truth is all you really mean is that the length is really big compared to the radius that you're considering. All right, so we have on the top of page 12 an infinite line charge, which is shown as this line with arrows on two sides. And I'd like to know, what is the electric field at some point, which I've labeled R, big R, outside of that infinite line charge? And to figure this out, I would like to choose a Gaussian surface. And I choose a Gaussian surface that fits the symmetry of the problem. So I'm choosing a cylinder with radius little r, which has an axis of symmetry centered on the line charge. And let's choose this cylinder. Remember, it's a closed surface, so it includes the end caps, to have length big L. And you say, well, what in the world is big L? Don't worry about big L yet, because it'll actually just fall out in the end. So it doesn't actually matter how long you choose the cylinder to be. So the symmetry of this problem is suited to a cylindrically symmetric Gaussian surface. We know that because it's an infinite line charge and there's nothing to break the symmetry or give you angular dependence or dependence along the line of charge, really, we know that we have to have just radial, that electric field is going to be radially outward for positive charge per unit length along the wire, positive charge. So I have chosen this closed Gaussian surface to look like a cylinder, which I've shown surrounding the infinite line charge, and we will break it into three little subsurfaces. One and two are end caps, and three is basically the pipe piece of the cylinder. This is a closed Gaussian surface, so let us say that Gauss's law is true. So at the bottom of page 12, we have Gauss's law be true. And now what I'd like to do is to think about the left-hand side of Gauss's law for each of these three surfaces. E is pointing radially outward. The N hat for surface 1 is pointing parallel to the line charge toward the left. The N hat for the little surface area labeled with the blue 2 in a circle in the Gaussian surface has an N hat which is pointing to the right and is parallel to the line charge. Both of those are perpendicular to the radial line, so E dot N hat is going to be 0 for 1 and 2, which means the surfaces, the ends of the cylinder in this case, do not contribute to the flux integral. So the only piece we have to consider is going to be surface 3, where E and N hat are parallel to one another. So for surface 3, E dot dA is going to be the magnitude of E at the radius at the radius of the Gaussian surface times dA for that surface. So the integral of E dot dA becomes the magnitude of E at that radius, which is constant because there's nothing to break the symmetry and that surface is all at the same radius away from the line. So we can pull it outside the integral, which we do in the middle of the second line on page 13. And we now have to integrate the area of the cylindrical pipe, that is the area of surface 3. Well, that area is going to be 2 pi little r because it's the Gaussian surface times the length L. So that's just the area of the pipe surface itself. And because it's Gaussian, because it's Gauss's law, this whole thing, second line of slide 13, is Q enclosed over epsilon naught. How much charge do we have? Well, we have the charge density times the length L. So Q enclosed inside the Gaussian surface is going to be lambda times L, and that's then over epsilon naught in Gauss's law. So if we pull all this thinking together, the left-hand side of Gauss's law becomes the magnitude of E times the surface area of the pipe, which is 2 pi r L, and that's equal to the right-hand side of Gauss's law, which is lambda L over epsilon naught. Now note, as promised, the L's canceled out, and we are able to solve for the magnitude of E as a function of radius. Since we chose the little r radius to be some arbitrary radius, you can now, that's true for any radius. So if we wanted to know what is the electric field out at big R, you would just put a big R in this expression. And if we ask for the electric field, it's important to actually say what is the direction as well as the magnitude, because it is a vector. And so in this case, because we have positive charge, it's pointed radially outward. Okay, so I think that's all I've got for you for this particular lecture. And I'll be back in town next Tuesday, and I will spend some time asking about questions for these particular lectures. I'll probably send you an email reminding you to sort of jot them down as you go. And, well, I'll see you soon. Bye.